you will capture the village of Pozieres. Slaughter had happened a week or so before. However, the 1st Division, they had very heavy fighting indeed and a great lot of casualties, and they did capture the village of Pozieres, and they went through it to the other side of it. Well, then our brigade came in, and we had to take over from where they were and carry on the fighting, go on further, as far as we could. And of course, the place at this time was one shambles of destruction. The whole of the village was a wreck. The place was turned up, and our headquarters was in the CO of the battalion was in a fort called Gibraltar. It was a German concrete dugout with about 8 foot, 6 or 8 foot of a tower above ground. That was the entrance to the stairs that went down. Now that was right in the centre of the village of Pozieres, and all the rest of the houses around it were absolutely smashed to pieces.
So they were the words spoken in an interview many years later by Private Fred Russell of the 22nd Battalion of the AIF, the Australian Imperial Force. And as you probably recognise if you've been to the Somme, he was talking about his experiences at Poisier, Gibraltar, Dead Man's Road, Moquet Farm, the windmill, the OG lines. Anyone that knows anything about the battle on the Poisier Heights in late July and early August of 1916 would have heard those phrases, would have read about them, would have hopefully and visited those sites which are still there. And there's more stuff there that I found recently, which I'm going to explain in this podcast, the latest episode in a podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefield. So before we go any further, let's go back and listen about what Fred has to say when he went up to Gibraltar, a place that's still there, still standing, still dominating the Australian lines, looking out across the Somme battlefield.
Through what they call the chalk pits, up into the valleys of Pozieres and beyond it, about half a mile, through just a maze of shell holes and destructive buildings and all this sort of thing. Our headquarters, this fort I referred to, Gibraltar, a 9-inch shell landed on top of it and exploded. Well, there were about 20 or 30 of our fellows down below in that. They were down about 15 or 20 feet in a concrete line. The concussion was terrific. The CO was down there himself. It was later Brigadier Bob Smith. But that was the effect of that shelling. You had to put up with that. And of course, all the time through the night and all the next day, shells were coming over. There was always continual yells for stretcher bearers. The fellows that dead had to be immediately, well, pushed over the back of the trench where we were in and left to it.
It amazes me when I sit here and listen to Fred's words, how he talks about the dead being thrown over the back of the trenches, about the wounded being evacuated. It's just a matter of fact. His memory is crystal clear, even after, 50, 60 years when he's given this interview. You really can't imagine the horror that he must have witnessed. Go to Gibraltar now, as I've done many times, and stood there. The remains of it are still there. You can look down the steps into the dugouts themselves, and it's the best place really on the Somme to get an idea of the strength of the German defences that they dug into the Chalklands all over that 18-mile stretch of the Battle of the Somme in 1916. It's no wonder they were relatively safe from the incredible British bombardment of the week before the 1st of July 1916. But this podcast this week is not about the 1st of July 1916. It's about late July and early August of 1916, when, just as Fred says, the Australian Imperial Force first of all took the village of Poisier and then had to fight the Germans to gain further ground to the east of Poisier, to the north of Moquet Farm. And during that, 4-week period, they had an incredible 23,000 casualties. Now, it's impossible, of course, to talk about each of those casualties. So what I've done for this podcast, as usual, is just to pick a few personal stories, a few personal recollections. And we're going to do that by visiting a few of the sites in and around that village. So I suppose the best place to start is where the Australians started. on the 23rd of July 1916. Today's date is the 28th of July 2023. So this is what, just over 107 years ago now. And if you go along the main road that leads from Albert to Bapaume, you'll come to the village of Poisiers. As you go through Poisiers, heading towards Bapaume, on the right-hand side, you'll see a road, the D73, which takes you to the village of Bazentin. If you take that road, come out of the village, and on the right-hand side, look across to the fields. And it's in these fields that at 12:30 on that morning of the 23rd, or just after midnight on the 23rd of July 1916, that the Australians moved out of their jumping-off tapes. Many crept out into no man's land to get as close as possible to the creeping barrage when it fell. And this is where their story starts. And we can consider the words of Sergeant H. Preston of the 9th Australian Battalion within the 1st Division. It was the 1st Division that made the initial attack on Poisiers. And he said, "Down came our barrage onto the enemy lines and Poisiers village, the Germans replying with artillery and machine gun fire. As we lay out among the poppies in no man's land, we could see the bullets cutting off the poppies almost against our heads. The flashes of the guns, the bursting of the shells and the very lights made the night like day. And as I lay as flat to the ground as possible, I was expecting to stop one any time. Jamming my tin helmet down on my head, I brought the body of my rifle across my face to stop anything that might happen to drop below. In a tumult, it was impossible to hear orders. My ears were ringing with the cracking of bullets. A man alongside me was crying like a baby, and although I tried to reassure him, he kept on saying that we would never get out of it. Suddenly I saw men scrambling to their feet. Taking this to be the signal of the charge, I jumped up and dashed across." His next statement I find really shocking. He said, "At the point where I entered there was a German doctor, who afterwards did good work among the wounded. Private Jack Rogers, who reached the trench with me, bayoneted two Germans, and after a sharp fight, the trench was cleared, and we immediately set to work to improve our position." But just listen to this next bit. Just listen to how they improve their position. I suppose when it comes to life or death, you'll do anything to make yourself safe from what they knew was going to be an enemy counterattack. He says, "Captain S.N. Lawrence was in charge of this work. The trench was in good order, with dugouts let into the sides." And then he says, "The dead bodies, which had to be thrown out, were used in building up the parapet." So, friend and foe, no doubt, they've used their bodies to shore up their defences and to use them, I suppose, as dead human shields to protect themselves from the incoming fire that they knew was about to happen. I have here a copy of a letter that was sent by 2nd Lieutenant John Alexander Rawes, and he was fighting within the 23rd Battalion of the AIF. He describes what he experienced at Poisiers. He said, "Our battalion had to march 3 miles under shell fire to go into no man's land in front of the German trenches, and we dug a narrow trench to be used as jump off in another assault. I was posted to bring up the rear and prevent straggling. It was awful, but we had to drive the men by every possible means. The wounded and killed had to be thrown to one side. I refused to let any sound man help a wounded man. The sound men had to dig. I took it on myself to insist on the men staying, saying that any man who stopped digging would be shot. We dug on and finished amid a tornado of bursting shells. I was buried twice and thrown down several times, buried with the dead and the dying. The ground was covered with bodies in all stages of decay and mutilation. And I would, after struggling free from the earth, pick up a body by me to try and lift him out with me and find him a decayed corpse. I pulled a head off, was covered with blood. The horror was indescribable. We are lousy, stinking, ragged, unshaven and sleepless. Even when we're back a bit, we can't sleep for our own guns. I have one putty, a dead man's helmet, another dead man's gas protector and a dead man's bayonet. My tunic is rotten with other men's blood and partly splattered with a comrade's brains. It is horrible, but why should you people at home not know? Several of my friends are raving mad. I met 3 officers out in no man's land the other night, all rambling and mad, the poor devils." Now, sadly, just a few weeks later, on the 23rd of August, Rawes himself was killed at Moquet Farm just a mile or so away from where he went into action initially, his body was never found. Then there was a man called John Harris, who was a school teacher in civilian life, but was now a captain in the 3rd Battalion of the AIF. He also wrote a very descriptive account of what happened that night. He said, "At last our guides arrived and we set off in single file for the trenches. It was not quite dark and we could see enough to pick our way after leaving the road and to discern some of the surroundings. As we went on, the grass became rarer and the shell holes more numerous. A faint, sickly smell came to our nostrils to remind us that we were passing over the ground captured from the Germans during the first attack on the 1st of July." He then goes on, he says, "Our trench was fortunately quite dry but rather unpleasant, owing to the fact that two bodies had been imperfectly buried in it, and the ground both to the front and rear was strewn with the unburied dead. One of our first duties was to send out a burial party to collect the identity disc and to bury the bodies nearest to the trench." Now, the next place that I wanted to describe what happened on that evening, and a place that's so well known to people from Australia, is the chalk pit, which was mentioned in the first account that we heard from Fred Russell. The chalk pit is still there. As you enter the village of Poisiers, again heading from Albert to Bapaume, on the left-hand side you'll see the memorial to the 1st Australian Division and the Gibraltar fortification that we've mentioned. And opposite there, there's a road which is actually signposted Dead Man's Road now. And if you go down there for about 500 yards, on the left-hand side behind a gate, is what was and still is the chalk pit. And this area comes up in so many personal accounts. And our correspondent Harris also mentions it. He says, "After resting for a couple of hours, we started getting our ammunition ready. Then came our first horror. A huge howitzer shell burst in our midst, killing several and wounded five, leaving some with their legs off and some with their arms off. All that was left of one poor man was his boots. I'd just moved away from the spot, so I only got covered with dust. Never will I forget the cries of those poor chaps." And he says that that incident took place beside the chalk pit on Dead Man's Road. No wonder it's called Dead Man's Road. There's no end of stories like that. And he goes on to say it was all the more heartbreaking because the main operation, scheduled for 12:30, had not even yet started. Harris then goes on to say, "When our bombardment opened, all hell let loose. The German first line was marked with an almost continuous wall of fire, with shrapnel bursting overhead and heavy explosives all around the line of the trench." Then, of course, over the top they went, up that hill. And a Lance Corporal Douglas Horton from the 1st Battalion described what happened when they went over the top. He said, "Here, one heard a chap calling for assistance, and knowing it was contrary to orders, one saw a boy walk over and bind up the wounded man. In another place in Poisiers Trench," which was the German frontline trench, "the Germans had been caught in their dugout and a Mills bomb had accounted for them. Here, several had been bayoneted, whilst lying around was the evidence of the intensity of our barrage. In one place, I saw a German, rifle to shoulder, finger crooked around the trigger, standing in the trench, but without the slightest movement. On walking up to him, I found he'd been killed by concussion and left standing where he was when the shell burst. There was no wound. Apparently the shell had landed close by. His heart had given one last jump and then forever stood still. I also passed an Australian and a German, each transfixed by the other's bayonet." Now, if you continue walking down what they call Dead Man's Road, you eventually come out onto the road, the D20, which, if you turn left, goes towards Contal Mason. But where the sunken road meets the D20, this was what was called Casualty Corner. And this was the main route to the front line for the parties that were carrying waters, rations and ammunition. But because the junction would have been marked on the German maps, shells fell heavily on this area. There was a Lance Corporal Morgan, and he wrote about this area. He said, "The scene is terrible. Dead and dying men lie on top of one another, many of them blown to pieces where they lay on the ground, while others lying helpless in the trenches were buried alive." Now, that man, the Australian official historian Charles Bean, as usual I like to quote him, and he said about this scene, this location, he said, "On its shattered banks, the corpses of both the Australians and of the British who had preceded them are strewn about." So from Casualty Corner, we turn left, head towards Contrell Mason, and then round the road goes round a bend, and then on the left-hand side is the D147, which takes you back up, if you followed it all the way, to Poisier. But we don't do that. We turn right, and there's a green sign pointing in the direction of two cemeteries on either side of this lane, this sunken lane. And indeed, one of those cemeteries is called the Sunken Road Cemetery, and on the other side of the path is the Second Canadian Cemetery. These two cemeteries were established between July and October 1916. And there's a number of casualties in these cemeteries from the Canadian attacks around Courcelette and Regina Trench area in October 1916, but we're not going to talk about those today because it's not part of this podcast. So we continue along this road, and we come to the junction of the D73, and this is the location where two Australian men were awarded the Victoria Cross for their efforts in this area. They were both attempting to lead attacks on what became known as the German OG lines, OG1, OG2, short for the old German lines, formidable German positions on the high ground. So let's look at these two soldiers. There's actually a sign there now on this junction. It was put there some years ago to say that this was the location where these two brave young men carried out their actions. Second Lieutenant Arthur Seaforth Blackburn was serving with the 10th Battalion of the AIF, and he came from a place called Woodville, Hyde Park in South Australia, and he was born in November 1892. He went to Adelaide University, where he graduated in law in 1913, and he enlisted with the 10th AIF as a private on the 19th of August 1914, so just a few days after the start of the war. In April 1915, he was involved in the Gallipoli campaign. He was promoted to Lance Corporal on the 27th of April, and he was commissioned as a platoon commander in A Company later that year in 1915. And then in February 1916, he was promoted to lieutenant, and with the rest of his comrades, they arrived in Marseille on the 2nd of April 1916, and on that morning, that dark morning, 23rd of July 1916, at Poisier, he was involved in the attack. And he survived, thankfully. Blackburn had been directed with 50 of his men to drive the enemy from a strong point. And by his great determination, they captured 250 yards of trench. And he personally led four separate parties of bombers against it, many of whom became casualties. Then after crawling forward with a sergeant to do a recce, he returned, attacked again, and seized another 120 yards of trench, and he established communication with the battalion on his left. But let's see exactly what he said about it in his own words. He said, "This was the biggest bastard of a job I've ever struck. Our heavies in the preliminary bombardment had knocked out part of OG1 out of existence, and Fridge could see into stretches of it from his second line, OG2. About every 20 yards, the trench would be obliterated for 3 or 4 yards, and you'd have to expose yourself to get any further. Of course, as soon as Fritz found that we were attacking it, he got machine guns and snipers trained onto the gaps, and this made it most unhealthy. In addition to this, his dugouts in the trench I was attacking were 30 to 40 deep, and he was fighting like fury to keep it." So what he's then done, he's crawled up to the junction of OG1 trench with Poisier trench, which was the frontline trench, only to find he was separated from the remainder of his troops by a German machine gunner who was firing from OG2. He said, "For a few moments it looked as though we were cut off, but on moving to the left flank up another trench, I discovered a ruined tunnel. On crawling down this tunnel, I began digging on the other side of it. I was blocked up with fallen earth. I was afraid this might lead to an enemy position, but on calling out, I was much relieved to ascertain that it was the 9th Battalion in the firing line in Poisier Trench. I'd very soon established a passage wide enough to crawl through. Captain Chambers of the 9th Battalion then immediately sent men and tools forward through this tunnel to my assistance, and we consolidated the position. I'd started at 5 in the morning on the 23rd of July. By 2 in the afternoon, I'd cleared up to Poisier Trench. I was relieved then, as I was just about collapsing. And during this operation, 14 of his colleagues had been killed. But for his efforts, he was awarded the Victoria Cross. He'd fallen ill in September with pleurisy and went to London. And he visited Buckingham Palace on the 4th of October 1916, where King George V presented him with his Victoria Cross. His health didn't improve. On the 16th of October, he returned to Australia, or restarted the journey back to Australia, and he arrived in Melbourne on the 1st of December. And he was discharged on medical grounds with a pension in April 1917. But his military career, it wasn't finished there. He became a lieutenant in the reserve officers from the 1st of October 1920. And he transferred to the citizens' military forces in 1925. Now, he got married. He married a lady called Rose Kelly on the 22nd of March 1917 in North Adelaide. They had four children. He went back to the legal profession. And then in 1940, May 1940, in the Second World War, he was appointed to command a machine gun battalion within the 2nd Battalion of the AIF. And then he was promoted to Lieutenant Colonel, and the battalion sailed for Syria in 1941. He was then promoted to Colonel, and he was posted, the battalion was posted to Sumatra, and their plan was to destroy an airfield, a Japanese airfield, because they'd secured it. He was involved in heavy fighting. On the 12th of March 1942, he was captured and held prisoner of war at camps in Singapore, in Japan, in Korea. He was finally liberated. He returned to Perth in 1945. And there was a civic reception which was attended by other Victoria Cross winners, Sir Roy Inwood and a Phil Davey. And he was appointed the CBE for his service during this campaign. In 1956, he attended the VC Centenary Celebrations in Hyde Park, London, and he travelled with several other fellow Australian VC reciprocants. But then he was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 1959, and the following year he died suddenly and was buried at the West Terrace Cemetery in Adelaide. His medals were originally passed to his eldest son, who was called Dick, and then his son Tom in 1987, but they've now been presented to the Australian War Memorial by the family. And if you're ever in Canberra and you visit the War Memorial, you'll see Arthur's Victoria Cross on display. And the other man that I mentioned was awarded the Victoria Cross in the same area for his efforts that night. It was a man called John Leake, a private in the 9th Australian Battalion. He was one of a party which finally captured an enemy strong point. And what he did when the German bombs were landing amongst his colleagues, and without orders, he jumped out of his trench. Don't forget, this man's a private, not an officer or an NCO. He ran forward under heavy machine gun fire at close range. He threw three bombs into the enemy's bombing post. He then jumped into the post. He bayoneted three unwounded enemy bombers. And it says that later, when the enemy in overwhelming numbers were driving his party back, he was always the last to withdraw at each stage, and he kept on throwing his bombs. When his officer reached the scene, it said that he found John Leake wiping the blood off his bayonet with his felt hat. And of course, he shouldn't have had his felt hat with him. He should have only had his helmet. Now, a few weeks later, on the 21st of August, he was wounded, still in the Poitiers area, with a gunshot wound to his back. And he was evacuated to Britain from Calais. He was released from hospital in October. And he also went to receive his Victoria Cross from King George V on the 4th of November. Now, what he experienced that night seems to have affected his behaviour for the rest of his war service. He did go back. He arrived back with the 9th Battalion in November 1917. And of course, this is the Battle of Passchendaele. And just before his platoon moved up, it was discovered that he was missing. And 6 days later, he was arrested in Calais in amongst soldiers that were going on leave. He didn't have a leave pass. He claimed his papers had been stolen, and he was tried by court-martial on the 23rd of November, and he pleaded not guilty to desertion. He was found guilty, but the court took into account his record, including his VCs and previous offences, and he was allowed to make a plea in mitigation, and he was sentenced to penal servitude for life. This was the most severe punishment for Australians in the First World War. They didn't execute any of their men. But under the Army Suspension of Sentences Act, penal servitude could be suspended and it allowed the soldier to return to active service, and that's what he did. He was kept in detention until the 23rd of December, returned to action. He was gassed on the 7th of March 1918 near Hollabeek, just south of Ypres, evacuated back to Britain. He then returned to France again in June 1918, reported sick with bronchitis. His suspended sentence was reviewed, and on Christmas Day, it was quashed. 5 days later, he married Beatrice at St John the Baptist Church in Cardiff. He applied to the Australian government for assisted passage for his wife, but that was refused. And he was finally discharged back in Australia in May 1919. But Beatrice, poor old Beatrice, she was left behind in Wales. She never did join him in Australia. There's no record of his marriage to her being annulled. And he married another woman, Ada, in 1927 in Western Australia. They had 8 children. He moved frequently around, working in Queensland, in New South Wales, and South Australia. He suffered medical problems for the rest of his life after the war, like so many of these men did. In later years, he suffered from bronchitis and emphysema, and he died following a heart attack on the 20th of October 1972, and he's buried alongside his second wife, Ada, in the Stirling District Cemetery in Adelaide. The story doesn't end there. Even after his death, there's controversy, because in February 1967, a gunsmith and a second-hand dealer named Harris appeared in court in Victoria for having forged 3 Victoria Crosses. And one of them was Leake's Victoria Cross. Hind was fined $40 Australian, and the forgery is destroyed, and the whereabouts of his real Victoria Cross isn't known. So that's the story in a nutshell, really, for the first day of the battle, the 23rd of July. The history of the 1st Battalion sums it up. It says, Sunday passed comparatively quietly. The line was not shelled very much, and we spent the day consolidating the positions taken up in the attack. Much hard work was done, none of us dreaming of the hell that was soon to be burst upon us. Because, yes, they'd successfully taken the village, or what was left of the village. It was just rubble, dust. But they knew it was coming, the German counterattack, and it soon did come, as the Germans bombarded the newly won positions that the Australians were now in. Captain J.R.O. Harris was with the 3rd Battalion, and he said most of the fire was in enfilade, and as the line ran parallel and close to the main road, our position was accurately marked down. As fast as one portion of the trench was cleared, another was blown in. There were no dugouts in which men on post could take shelter, and the only thing to do was grin and bear it. The shells, which would drop in almost perpendicularly, could be clearly seen in the last 40 feet of their descent, and the whole trench was methodically dealt with. It goes on to say the men who were not wounded were kept busy digging out men who were buried alive by the explosions, caving in the trench sides. I had occasion to bless my tin hat, for in our portion of the trench the parapet was composed of the debris of a ruined house, and a shell pushed over a barrowload of bricks onto my head, and no other ill effect but some bruises on the shoulders. Private Frank Bent, 2nd Australian Battalion, he said, without doubt Poisier was the heaviest, bloodiest, rottenest stunt that the Australians were caught up in. The barrage is just indescribable. As we were making our attack under the 3rd Brigade had gone through, we were literally walking over the dead bodies of our cobbers that had been slain by his barrage. I can't imagine anything more concentrated than the artillery barrage of the Germans at that particular stunt. He was even shelling our front line with great coal boxes. His artillery was registered right smack on it. During the whole of this period, I can't remember anything more nerve-wracking than the continuous shelling day and night. Even as now I sit here reading these accounts in my study, it's almost making me shake just trying to imagine what those men were going through. There's no defence, is there? I think this is the thing I can't get in my head, that if you're in a punch-up or a bayonet fight or medieval fighting, you're seeing your enemy face-to-face. You know, you've got a weapon, he's got a weapon, and it's whoever the strongest man is will survive. But in this case, as it used the words in the Great War, indiscriminate. They're being killed, slain by guns being fired from an invisible enemy a long way away in some cases. They don't actually get to see the men that are attacking them. And there's no way that they can defend themselves. Where do they go? What can they do? No wonder these men suffered, the survivors suffered mentally, mental scars for the rest of their lives. It's hardly surprising, really, is it? When the 1st Australian Division were relieved from the line, they'd lost 181 officers and over 5,000 other ranks, killed, wounded, a few taken prisoner and missing, of course. Now, the newly arrived Australian replacements had a problem because although the village had been taken, those OG lines 1 and 2 had not. They were still in German hands, and behind them was the windmill, the site that was and still is the highest point on the Somme. It's not Tietvau. Tietvau, of course, you can see that from most of the battlefield. But I measured it in my car, and it's a few metres higher is the site of this windmill. And this was still in German hands. The Germans could see and dominate the battlefield. Poitiers was just a few hundred yards away, what was left of it. But now they had to take those OG lines and the windmill before they could continue the campaign towards Bapaume, the town, of course, that the Battle of the Somme, that they never, ever did reach. At 12:15 a.m. on the 26th of July 1916, the Australians attacked the OG line, and for several hours the success or failure of the attack was unclear. But at 3:15 a.m. they received at HQ the bad news that two of the three assaults had failed. Some of them had reached OG2 but had driven back, or some of the brigade had been held up and trapped on the wire, which was uncut. It hadn't been broken by the artillery barrage. To the south, two companies of the 20th Battalion had been cut down even as they began to move forward, and in consequence, the bombing party had not even left their starting positions. And this first major offensive by the 2nd Australian Division was almost a complete failure. But what was it like to be involved in that attack that night? Whether there was a Private Tom Young, he was with the 27th Battalion, and a stretcher bearer, and he watched what happened. He said they marched across no man's land as if they were on parade ground, with their own shells screaming in droves above their heads and the German shells blowing them to bits. The men dropped like flies. The German wire remained intact, and they could go neither forward nor back. They tore at the barbed wire with their hands, searching for openings under one of the most intense machine gun barrages Australians have ever faced. But they did get into these OG lines. A corporal, Percy Blythe, with the 28th Battalion, he said, "We left the long line of the best and the bravest boys that Australia ever produced lying along the wire. Some fell across it with their wires in their hands. Others died with the wire cutters still on the wire. But they were glorious lads, every one of them. I got into a shell hole right under his wire and could go no further forward. So I sent my supply of bombs in the direction of his machine gun right in front of me. I cannot vouch for the result. By this time, everything was in a state of chaos, and I took the risk of going from shell hole to shell hole, trying to get the boys together for another try. The word came up for us to withdraw to our original front line. They all did this, but I stayed and did my best for several wounded fellows." Percy's efforts are in fact mentioned by a Private Norgaard. He'd been badly hit. He said, "I stopped it and promptly dropped into a shell hole. I took what was left of the boot off and bandaged the wound as quickly as possible. Our poor chaps were falling like ninepins everywhere. I assumed a very painful crawl, and I got back to a starting point with a couple more minor hits on the ribs. Percy Blythe got me safely back to the aid post." And no doubt he always remembered the man that helped him get back for treatment. Blythe himself was wounded, as we know, but he was awarded the military medal for his efforts. But a few days later, they did succeed. On the night of the 30th, the 31st of July, they actually fired 5,000 shells prior to the attack. The attack was set for 9:15 p.m. to give the troops sufficient light to see their objectives. But of course, that meant that the Germans could also see them. At 6 p.m, the final stage of the bombardment commenced. But this, of course, alerted the Germans to the attack that was about to begin. And at 9 p.m, the barrage stopped. And at 9:15 p.m, The heavy and field guns resumed firing on OG-1, and then after 3 minutes they lifted to the OG-2 trenches for a further 3 minutes before lifting to the rear areas. And then over the top they went, and this time they succeeded. By nightfall the whole objective had been taken, with the exception of part of OG-2. But we know what comes next, don't we? It's those German counterattacks again. And they did counterattack, but the Australians held them off. A man that we've not talked about before was a man called Philip Gibbs. And he was a journalist who witnessed much of the Somme battle. And he wrote his memoirs in a book that he called The Battles of the Somme. And in that book, he talks about the high ground at Poitiers, and he witnessed what happened that night. He said, it was, I think, about 9 o'clock when the British and Australians left their trenches. They went quietly without any great clamour across the 500 yards of ground. Dusky figures, the brown of their khaki no different from the colour of earth around them through the gloom of the coming night. The Australians worked up the right and the British to the left. Before them was the German second line on a front of about 3,000 yards and part of the long line which was pierced and taken on the 14th. It was no longer a line of trenches. It was a wavy line of hummocky and tumbled earth amongst innumerable shell craters. Only the dugouts or some of them still remained in all this chaos, filled with living and the wounded and the dead. Out of the wreck of earth as our men advanced, living men came out in groups. And by that he means the Germans. They came forward through the dusky night with their hands held up. Pitiable shadows. Most of them were utterly nerve-broken, beaten and broken men with no fight left in them, but only an animal fear and desire of life. Their surrender was received, and the English and Australians put guards on them and sent them back to our lines. And they went on to clear the dugouts of men who refused to come out or would not come out, and to deal with those further back had still the courage to defend themselves. There was some bayonet fighting and bombing. From behind the German lines in isolated redoubts, machine gunners were at work splaying out bullets. But our casualties were very few, all told less, I imagine, than in any action of importance during the Battle of the Somme. The enemy's losses were more heavy. More than 400 prisoners had passed through, and others were being brought down. In dead, he lost more than that, and his wounded must number high figures. It was a blow which must be grievous to him after all the hammer strokes of the month. And what is most significant is the troubled state of his soldiers. Those days, the nerve-shattered men who surrendered, they had no pride left in them. Now, we know what comes next, don't we? Because shattered and nerve-broken those Germans may be, but of course they then bring up reinforcements, and the first thing they do is counterattack to try and take the high ground around the windmill and those OG lines. Gibbs goes on to explain what happened next. He says, during the night, the troops behind them were rallied to make three separate counterattacks. They came on very bravely. There is nothing the matter with German courage as a rule, but in a spirit of self-sacrifice and stupidity, they walked into our barrage and our shells caught them and shattered them. And there ended the Australian and British attack on Poitiers. They'd finally taken the heights. The 2nd Division of the Australians were relieved by the 7th of August. They'd been under continuous bombardment and hand-to-hand fighting for 12 days and 12 nights. And during that period, they'd lost 230 officers and over 6,600 other ranks. They'd finally achieved what they intended to do. Now, I'm going to read something now, which there's a lot of people from Australia listen to this podcast. And we talked about the heroism, quite rightly, of the Australians and the VCs and the efforts of all of the men there and the dreadful casualties. But I'm now going to read something that Haig, the commander-in-chief of the BEF, wrote in his diary. And he's written this about the first failed attack. He said, the attack by the 2nd Australian Division upon the enemy's position between Poitiers and the windmill was not successful last night. From several reports, I think the cause was due to want of thorough preparation. After lunch, I visited HQ Reserve Army and impressed on Gough and his GSO, Neil Malcolm, that they must supervise more closely the plans of the Anzac Corps. Some of their divisional generals are so ignorant, and like many colonials, so conceited, that they cannot be trusted to work out unaided the plans of attack. I'm reading that without comment. Obviously, in hindsight, I'm sure he wished, I'd hope he wished, that he didn't write those words, but he did. We can't change history. I thought twice about including that in there because I know this is going to annoy and infuriate people from Australia. But it's history, and as I say, we can't change it. So I thought it was only fair to include that passage. A few days later, they did manage to take the windmill and those OG lines. So perhaps, I don't know, but perhaps Haig had to eat his words in the end. Now, what I should have said at the start of this is how you get there to those OG lines. Well, it's very easy to find from the site where Leake and Blackburn carried out their VC actions. You turn left to go along the road in the direction of Poitiers. When you reach the main road at Poitiers, you turn right a few hundred yards, you leave the village, and then on the left-hand side, you'll see that a few years ago, the locations of the OG1 and OG2 lines have actually been marked out in the field. And then a few yards beyond that, you come to the site of the windmill itself. And this is a position that the Germans had held since 1914 when they arrived in the Somme area. And when you stand there now on the rubble of the German defences there, you get a magnificent view of all around the battlefield. You can clearly see Thiepval, of course, you can see back to Bapaume, you can see to the north and the south of the battlefield, and you can see all the way back to the British base town of Albert. Really is a fantastic place to stand and look at the battlefields to this day. The windmill, of course, by 1916 had completely been smashed up by, first of all, the French and the British artillery fire, and it was just a pile of rubble, really, but of course the Germans used that as a defensive position. And the remains of the windmill and the German blockhouse that was there have been left. The area has now been grassed over, but it's been turned into a memorial site. And on the other side of the road is the tank memorial. So, as I say, it's a very easy location to find, and it's well worth stopping on the main road there and going to have a look at what's there. And also, what I would suggest you do is take these accounts along with you so you get some idea of what those Australians went through whilst they were attacking those positions, and also what they went through during those counterattacks. So what did the Germans see from the other side of the wire? During that initial assault on the OG lines and the windmill, one German wrote, "When daylight came, we could see that countless Australians were lying in a carpet, in some places two or three on top of one another. It was an appalling sight. A few Australians were brought back as prisoners. They were big stalwart lads who made a good impression as soldiers, and they were magnificently equipped." And as we know, the whole of the Somme is still a burial ground. So many of those soldiers that were killed across the whole Somme battlefield still have no known grave. And that's especially the case around the windmill sites, around Poitiers. And another German wrote that 10,000 men were killed in that plateau and buried and unburied and buried and unburied, till no bit of dust is without a man upon it. It's difficult to imagine that now. When you walk across there, you walk across there in the winter, the fields have been ploughed, it's cold, it's windswept, but it's very quiet. And then in the summer months, as it is now, the crops are in the field, blowing in the breeze. And then you think of that statement, 10,000 men were killed, buried and unburied, buried and unburied. They're still there, so many of those men, Australians, Canadians, British and Germans, of course. But as you wander along the road, that road up to Poitiers, you could almost miss it. But on the right hand side, there is a memorial to a man called George Butterworth. George was an English composer, a folk song collector and a country dancer. And he was killed near this spot on the 5th of August 1916 whilst serving with the 13th Battalion of the Durham Light Infantry. In the final hours of his life, he was ordered to dig a trench to link up with the German-held Munster Valley. But while he was doing this, he was spotted by a German sniper and shot and killed immediately. Before he joined the army, he'd made himself into a famous composer. Probably his colleagues, his comrades, didn't know this. And when he died, he was buried near where he fell. His grave was unfortunately lost, and he's one of those that's remembered on the Tietvale Memorial. But on the British trench maps after his death, the place where he died was renamed Butterworth Trench in his memory. And when you do find that memorial there, this is what it says on it: in memory of Lieutenant George Stainton K. Butterworth, MC, 13th Battalion, Durham Light Infantry, born on the 12th of July 1885, died on the 5th of August 1916, aged 31, within sight of this memorial. It says he was a musician, composer, collector of English folk songs and Morris dancer. And then it says, quite telling words really, great in what he achieved, greater still in what he promised. One of the lads that would die in their glory and never be old. Which, of course, is very true for George, but is true for all of the hundreds and thousands of other British and Commonwealth soldiers that died on the Western Front and beyond. What would he achieve? What would he have succeeded in if he'd been able to continue with that career as a composer? But he's left us with a legacy, and this is his most famous piece of music that he composed. And it's called The Banks of Green Willow. But we're not finished in Poitiers, because there's still more to see, quite a bit more actually. From the site of the windmill, you walk back towards Poitiers, retracing your steps along the main road. You pass the water tower with the names of the Victoria Cross recipients that won their awards in and around Poitiers village. And then a little way along, you'll see a path going off to the right. And then you go down there and then you turn to the left, and there's some information boards showing photos of what this area looked like in August of 1916. And as you walk along the back of these gardens, there's a fence protecting the fields on the right-hand side, and over to your right you can see the Tietvale Memorial. And as you get probably three quarters of the way down this path, heading in the direction of the church in Poitiers, in the garden on the left-hand side, there's an enormous bunker. No doubt a German bunker, sunken into the ground, big enough to have housed dozens of men, probably. And of course, that would have made up some of those strong defences in the village of Poitiers. And you can only imagine the fighting that would have taken place in and around this concrete bunker on the morning, the early hours of the morning on that day, the 23rd of July 1916. But it's part of someone's garden now. You can't access it, obviously, if it's in their garden. But as I say, if you come from the other direction, if you come into this path from the other direction near the church, it's on the right-hand side, just about 50 yards along, but it's covered in vegetation, and it's not obvious that it's a dugout, a concrete pillbox, until you almost get past it and you look back, and then you can see the entrance to it, and you can see where it's sunk, and you can see where it's been damaged by shellfire as well. So it's a place that's off the beaten track. Unless you walk around the back there, you wouldn't know it was there. And I'm not sure it's in any of the guidebooks. And then keep walking along that grassy path. You come out by the church and then you head for the Australian First Division Memorial, which is back to where you can leave your car and where the location of Gibraltar is that we featured in the words of Fred Russell at the start of this podcast. So now what I've done to finish the podcast is to have a look at the casualty figures. As we know, there was approximately 23,000 casualties in total. And looking at the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website, you can download the information into a spreadsheet and then sort it as you wish. And I found 3,500 soldiers from Australia that are buried or remembered on the Somme or close to the Somme battlefields or in other cemeteries up on the coast that were no doubt casualties from the battle. This is by no means a scientific way of discovering how many died, and I'm sure that's not the final figure, but it does tell us where most of these soldiers are buried. And unsurprisingly, a lot of them are buried in the Poisiers British Cemetery, which is near to where they fell. There are in fact well over 200 Australian soldiers in this cemetery, and not long ago I was wandering around there looking for a lad from Northampton, and I met a man that had come all the way from Australia, and he was spending the evening going round in the cemetery, and he was trying to find every single Australian that was there. It would have taken him some time, well over 200, but I'm sure he achieved it. Over 90 of them are buried in Corsolet British Cemetery, and incredibly, nearly 200 of them are buried behind the lines at a place called, I'm not sure whether I pronounce this right, Pushy Villas British Cemetery. And I know that that was the location of a casualty clearing station, and that would suggest that the Australians that died there would have died of their wounds. Then there's the vast Sayre Road No. 2 cemetery, which was established, a concentration cemetery established after the armistice, mainly when the graves were brought in from all over the area. And there's about 190 Australian bodies that are buried in there. But as you would expect, looking at the nature of the fighting and of like that German said that so many of these soldiers were buried and unburied, so many of them do not have a known grave. And over 2,000 of them, so that's well over half of the Australian casualties, have no known grave. And they're remembered on the Australian Memorial at Villers Bretonneux, which is about 20 miles away from where they've died. Now, as people know, when soldiers, Australians included, were wounded on the battlefields, there was an evacuation process well established by 1916 that took the casualties out of the trenches through this process of advanced dressing stations, casualty clearing stations, base hospitals, and eventually they would be brought back to hospitals in the United Kingdom. And here in Northamptonshire, we had over 30 of these hospitals, several within the town itself. And at Duston in Northampton, some of these Australians were brought back and many of them recovered and returned either to the front or went back to Australia. But there are two that are buried in the Toaster Road Cemetery here in Northampton that are casualties of the fighting in and around Poisiers. The first one is a man called Walter Cox. Like all of these Australians, or most of them anyway, he'd fought at Gallipoli in 1915. And on the 5th of August, so right at the tail end of the Battle for Poitiers, he was wounded whilst helping a wounded comrade, which of course he wasn't supposed to do, but he did because that's nature, isn't it? That's human nature. 2 days later, his condition was being described as dangerously ill, and he was one of 100 patients who arrived in Northampton on the 14th of August, 1916. So what's that, 9 days after he'd been wounded? He was taken to Duston Hospital, suffering from a shell wound to the spine, and it had left him paralysed. Now, he did improve for a while. He died on the 22nd of September 1916, aged 32, and his funeral was held 4 days later. His mum, of course, on the other side of the world, couldn't be there. But thankfully, she knew that the people of Northampton were looking after her boy, and she wrote a letter to the local newspaper. She said, "May I express my gratitude to you on my own behalf, and I'm sure I'm also voicing the feelings of others who are buried in your cemetery. It is a great consolation to know that their spots, so sacred to us, will in future be looked after, and like the spirits of our dear dead heroes, will hover over the young helpers in their good work." Private Charles Henry McGoldrick was serving with the 1st Battalion of the Australian Infantry. He'd only joined them 2 weeks before when he was wounded near Poitiers. The ground they were holding was swept with artillery and machine gun fire, and he was shot in the knee. He was transferred to base hospital near Boulogne, and there the doctor that was treating him wrote a letter to his wife Reedy in Australia. And this is what he said in the letter: "I'm sorry to have to tell you that your husband has been wounded through the right knee. The wound was a very severe one, and from the first it seemed likely that he would have to lose his leg, but an attempt was made to save it. After a week, he developed a severe inflammation of the knee joint and the surrounding parts, and in order to save his life, the leg had to be amputated. Since the operation, he's done very well, and is now, I hope, well on the way to recovery." So he arrived at Duston Hospital in Northampton, and he contracted pneumonia. He was a Catholic, Roman Catholic, and there was a Canon Ashmole from the Roman Catholic Cathedral here in Northampton. He wrote a letter to Charles's sister, and he said that Charles was anxious that you and his family should know that he's had the great consolation. He wishes you to communicate this to his other relations. He's quite resigned and peaceful. And then he died on the 16th of September 1916, aged 25 years old. His body was carried on a gun carriage by the Royal Field Artillery. And the footnote to this story is that for once, someone has managed to get from Australia to see his grave. In 2013, on Anzac Day, 10 years ago, his grandson Sydney visited Charles's grave with his wife and nephew. So he's definitely one Australian casualty that is buried on the other side of the world, but he's definitely not forgotten. And none of these soldiers are forgotten, because I've noticed in recent months, the Australians are now starting to come back to the Somme. It's taken a long time for them to be able to do so after the COVID crisis, but they are coming back. Some of them are coming on day trips from cruises, either river cruises or coming up from Paris as part of a wider European tour. And that's great to see. It really is. It's wonderful to hear the Australian voices once again on the Somme, on a pilgrimage, looking for those places like the Windmill, where their ancestors fought and maybe gave up their lives. And that proves, if they're making all that effort to come all the way from Australia, that these men will never be forgotten. Neither, as we talk about this, were those German men that held the line or tried to hold the line, that took part in the counterattacks. They won't be forgotten either. All the time that we keep returning to the battlefields and telling the stories that I've been telling in this podcast, Tales from the Battlefields. So once again, thank you very much for tuning in, and I'm not sure what we're going to do next week. Haven't decided. We've got some exciting projects coming up over the next few weeks. Please do leave a review on Spotify or on Apple. And I also found out recently that the podcast was being published on Amazon Music. That's another outlet which I wasn't aware of. And I think it's probably on some of the other outlets as well. I don't really understand how they get on there, but I'm fortunate they are, because it means that more people get the opportunity to listen to them. I wanted to give the final word to the Australian historian Charles Bean. He said that this place around Poitiers is more densely sown with Australian sacrifice than any other place on earth. And as usual, we'll sign off this week by playing the last post in memory of all soldiers from all nations that died in and around Poitiers in July and August 1916.